is 17-1106 Montoya v. Vigil. Mr. Daugherty?
Thank you, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. Peter Daugherty here. May it please the Court. I represent one of the three appellants in this action, Jonathan Priest. With me at counsel table is Leif Dustat. Also at counsel table are the attorneys representing the other two defendants in this case, Courtney Kramer for Michael Martinez and Andrew Ringel for Martin Vigil. Your Honors, by agreement of the parties, I will argue on behalf of the three appellants. To the extent that there are any questions that are properly addressed to any of the individuals, I'll gladly yield the podium. Also, Your Honor, I'd like to argue for 12 minutes and reserve 3 minutes if possible. Your Honors, this case involves an interlocutory appeal concerning three officers of the City of Denver Police Department. All three officers have asserted qualifying immunity, and Officers Priest and Vigil have also argued the defense of testimonial immunity with respect to their trial testimony. The plaintiff in this case was convicted in the 2000 murder of Emily Johnson, who was a Denver school teacher who was killed in her home. As part of that crime, her Lexus was stolen. The three officers in this case were involved in the initial investigation, were also involved in the interview of Mr. Montoya back in 2000. Very briefly, a timeline is helpful. There was an interview that took place on January 10th of 2000. Following that, an arrest warrant was issued and served on January 11th. As part of the initial investigation, there was the interview that took place on the 10th, and it is part of that the plaintiff argues violated the Fifth Amendment right. There are two parts of that interview. The first part was about 15 minutes with the mother present, and then the mother left afterwards. There was an arrest that took place, as mentioned, on January 11th, and following that, there was a preliminary hearing on February 25th, and then a suppression hearing that took place in June, which dealt with that second portion of the interview. And then the trial took place on October 2000, and Mr. Montoya was convicted of four of the five criminal counts brought against him. And he served 13 years as a result of that. In early 2014, Mr. Montoya's counsel brought a Rule 35C proceeding in the state court to challenge the conviction based upon ineffective assistance of counsel. That motion is included in our record as document 52-3. In June of 2014, there was a hearing, and it was agreed there would be a compromised conviction, that the original conviction would be set aside in exchange for Mr. Montoya pleading guilty to a sixth count, which was accessory to murder after the fact. This case was then filed 2 years after that.
Before we get to the merits, what about Mr. Montoya's point that we lack jurisdiction over the malicious prosecution and false arrest claims because of your failure to argue qualified immunities specifically below in the motion to dismiss?
Your Honors, we did raise that qualified immunity as it related to all of the arguments. And in fact, the plaintiff himself in the response to the motion to dismiss included an argument specifically dealing with the malicious prosecution as part of their brief, and that's found at page
44. Right, I saw that, but in your moving papers, did you do so?
I believe so, Your Honor. In the initial standard of care, we included the qualified immunity argument, and we also argued necessarily the first prong of the qualified immunity argument.
You're not arguing clearly established.
Exactly.
You're not on appeal, are you?
The clearly established, we argued with respect to the concerns regarding the Fifth Amendment. With respect to the malicious prosecution, we're arguing the essential elements of that claim, which would be the first prong, whether the defendants violated a constitutional claim.
There's two ways you can argue the first prong of qualified immunity, I mean the substance of it. The first is to move to dismiss and say that this is fails under 12b-6 because there is no constitutional violation. There's maybe a substantively identical, but it may have different ramifications for purposes of appellate jurisdiction to argue that we are entitled to qualified immunity because of the first prong of qualified immunity. And so when you say that we necessarily address the first prong of qualified immunity, in your moving papers, did you actually say that we are entitled to dismissal of the malicious prosecution and false arrest claims based on the first prong of qualified immunity, or mention qualified immunity at all with regard to those two claims?
So I know that we certainly mentioned it during oral argument with Judge Mage, and whether we included it specifically as a predecessor to those arguments, I do not believe that we did that specifically, but it was incorporated in the arguments. Judge Mage understood that we were arguing qualified immunity as to all of those, and in the motion papers by the in the response submitted by the appellee, similarly understood that those were our arguments. And I would also argue that those, all of those arguments have been presented here, and procedurally what would occur would be a remand to the district court for us to simply reassert that qualified immunity defense with just the footnote, this is a qualified immunity as to all of these claims.
Or to dismiss that portion of the appeal for which we lack appellate jurisdiction.
There is that possibility also, Your Honor.
Now, the one thing that I didn't see, but I may have overlooked it, is on the false arrest claim. I don't see where Judge Mach actually ruled on qualified immunity with regard to the false arrest claim. Did I overlook that?
No, Your Honor. With respect to the false arrest claim, I think it's originally, as we understood the claim of false arrest, it was being brought as part of that malicious prosecution claim. And it wasn't until really the reply brief that we have, I'm sorry, the answer brief on appeal, that that's carved out as being a separate argument factually, meaning that the custodial interrogation is now being described as an arrest. And that isn't included in the complaint, nor was it argued throughout any of the briefing or the motion before. But you're right. With respect to that specific element, Judge Mates, I don't believe, had the opportunity to address that because I don't think it was part of that initial.
And wouldn't that entail a fact question? That is, what status was he in? Was he merely detained? Was he under interrogation? Had he been arrested? How long did the detention last?
I believe that, yes, if in fact there was an argument that there was actually an arrest that was taken, there have been times where I have seen Judge Mage address that under a qualified immunity analysis, but in this particular instance, that was not the argument that was presented below.
But is it a fact question?
Yes, Your Honor.
So we wouldn't have jurisdiction to address it?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Turning back to the malicious prosecution, why also would it not be a fact question whether Montoya had presented enough evidence that he was actually innocent of the murder charge, and that would satisfy our favorable, and that if a jury found that, it would satisfy the favorable termination prong of malicious prosecution?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Looking at the cases that this court has issued, looking at the Sanchez versus Hartley case, going back to Wilkins versus DeReyes, the way that this court has addressed the malicious prosecution, and particularly that exoneration element, is there must be an indicia of innocence in how this has been addressed. And the decisions from this case talk about if there is a compromise, that takes it out of, and it's not a demonstration of innocence. And certainly if the circumstances surrounding this are one in which you see that there is, say, a mercy requested, mercy granted, or there is a compromise, that simply is not the situation. And the cases that have been before this court, that this court has issued, there are numerous cases in which it has not been found to be a fact determination when it is clear that...
Is it a per se rule? No matter what the compromise charges are, does that matter?
If we go back to say with... to answer your question, I don't believe that there is a per se rule, But where I've seen that this court has asked for an additional analysis is, like, give an example in Wilkins versus DeReyes, when there was a nulla prosequi, where the district attorney abandoned all charges. In that case, this court then looked at the underlying circumstances to see if there was an indicia of any type of innocence. Looking at other cases when there has been a compromise, or when there have been circumstances which show that this is not because of a clearly established abandonment where there is an indicia of innocence, they say, okay, then yes, that is something that we will take away from and give to the jury. I think this is a very much a legal determination, and that based upon the precedent in this jurisdiction, that it certainly is something that the court looks objectively to say whether there is an indicia.
But is it appropriate on a 12b6 motion as opposed to, say, a summary judgment? I mean, what you've just been discussing sounds pretty fact-laden. It could be, it could not be. Let's look at the circumstances surrounding the subsequent plea to this particular charge.
How did
it all happen? I mean, that's...
Your Honor, I believe it is appropriate on a 12b6 motion or under the first prong of a qualified immunity to make that determination whether the essential elements have been established. And in this particular case, looking at the circumstances that surround it, there is not that indicia of innocence. Going back, and you keep in mind that in this particular instance, there was a Rule 35C motion for ineffective assistance of counsel. And when you look at terms of what that ineffective assistance counsel was and the relief that was being requested, there was a request for a new trial or a new conviction, new sentencing. But overall, there was not the showing that this was going to be an innocence charge. And that certainly was not the reason why Judge Bronfen went forward with Rule 35C, or why the district attorney agreed to allow for this compromise. It was not because of innocence. Rather, it was because there was an effort to address this and to allow the parties to move forward with a compromised sentencing. Your Honors, if I may briefly touch on the issue of testimonial immunity, because I think that addresses and helps to curtail the Fifth Amendment issue that we have. Reagan versus Polk, which was the U.S. Supreme Court decision which provided testimonial immunity for officers who testified at trial, extended that to a probable cause hearing. In this particular case, the two officers that are part of the claims involved, their testimony include Jonathan Priest, who did not testify as to the Fifth Amendment or to the interrogation. But we have Detective Vigil, who testified as to a portion, and there's some convolutedness as far as what he actually testified to. Regardless, in Rayburg, we believe that the testimony of both those individuals is not appropriate, and that they're entitled to absolute immunity. And then backing from that, if we're looking at whether it's appropriate or not under a Fifth Amendment analysis to say that it was inappropriate to include any of those statements as part of the affidavit, I don't believe that that was clearly established law. And if we look at this court's decision last year of Vogt versus City of Hays, it becomes apparent that what we're looking at is an issue where these individuals could not have anticipated what the law was at that time. We're saying that a Fifth Amendment privilege relates to some time earlier than the actual trial that's in front of a jury. And similarly, as in what happened in Vogt, where you applied qualified immunity to the conduct that took place in 2013 and 14, we'd ask for a similar application in this case, which would mean that we're not saying that the Fourth Amendment malicious prosecution claim is undermined by Rayburg or by Vogt, but rather what we are just saying is that that really is the only standalone claim that then survives, and we don't have a separate Fifth Amendment claim.
The anomaly here, unlike in Vogt, is that what the officers testified to was just wrong. Montoya didn't say what the officer attributed to Mr. Montoya. And so when you argue that, well, he didn't use anything that there was no use of the self-incriminating statements, well, it's a little bit of anomalous to say that because the officer testified either by mistake or by fabrication, because Montoya never said that, for example, he was friends with Nicholas, or that he had had prior, that he had known Nicholas from prior occasions, unlike the officer's attribution to Montoya during the trial testimony.
Your Honor, I see my time is up. If I may briefly address that.
Go ahead.
Your Honor, with respect to factually whether he was incorrect or wrong, or whether, and using the most extreme example, that he perjured himself, which I don't believe that the facts bear out. Regardless, under Rayburg, there would be absolute immunity for that. And Rayburg and the cases that follow talk about the fact that even if any part of a constitutional claim that's based upon that testimony cannot be permitted to proceed, that part is barred. So then you look at whether there's something else. And as this court said in Sanchez last year, there may be other things that may be available, other constitutional claims, in applying Rayburg. But in this case, we don't have that as a part of the standalone portion of the case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. It's still morning. Jane Byrie-Alson on behalf of Mr. Montoya. May it please the Court. This case is about Lawrence Montoya, who was a 14-year-old boy that was coerced into confessing something he did not do. It's about a boy that was falsely arrested and held in custody for many, many hours until the wrongful institution of legal process or malicious prosecution started against him with the issuance of an arrest warrant based solely on his false coerced confession. As a result of all those things, Mr. Montoya spent almost 14 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. As the Court's well aware, we're here on an interlocutory appeal, but Mr. Montoya deserves his day in court, in district court, to flush out the record in this case, which is why I first want to address the issue of jurisdiction in this case. As we've argued in our briefs, it's our position that, with all due respect, that this Court only has jurisdiction over the Fifth Amendment claim, over the defendant's arguments on the Fifth Amendment claim. We say that because the defendants invoke the collateral order doctrine, allowing for interlocutory's appeal, where there's been a denial of a motion to dismiss based on qualified immunity. But that's not what happened in this case. The defendants claim in their reply brief that they did raise qualified immunity as to the malicious prosecution claim and the false arrest claim. And in doing so, they cite to the entirety of their 12b6 motion and their entirety of their reply to our opposition. But I have gone back and reviewed those motions very carefully, and I just don't see it in there.
Did it come up at oral argument on the motions? And it's not ideal, but does that get us close enough?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I went back and reread the transcript of oral arguments, and although, and this is quoted in the defendant's reply brief, there is a statement where the district judge says, and I quote, "Well, your position, as I got it then, is that first of all, there's no constitutional violation, and second of all, there's qualified immunity." To which defense counsel at the time answers, "Yes, Your Honor, that's correct." But when you go back and you read the transcript that precedes that one statement that they're now pulling out to claim that they argued it as to all the claims, the entire discussion between the court and defense counsel preceding that is only as to the Fifth Amendment claim. It does
However,
not.
However, on page 6 of the order, in the first full paragraph, Judge May says that qualified immunity has been invoked by the individual defendants. And then in the third sentence says that the Fourth and Fifth Amendment violations pleaded are clearly established law. Then the next sentence says the defendants, Vigil, Martinez, and Priest, do not have qualified immunity for the claim of malicious prosecution. So even though I think that there's much to be said for what you had just said as far as whether the defendants had actually argued qualified immunity on the malicious prosecution claim, it appears to me that Judge Mache actually ruled on that. And so don't we have appellate jurisdiction based on the denial of qualified immunity on the malicious prosecution claim?
I think you may, Your Honor, but I still would. I agree that Judge Mache's opinion has that one line in it. I don't know what he's basing that on. I still believe that they didn't raise it, but I do believe you have discretion to hear that issue, which then brings me, and I'm happy to argue in regards to the favorable termination prong. Again, although we don't believe that there is jurisdiction over it, the defendants, and in their brief, even in their appellate brief, argued that Mr. Montoya failed to state a claim for malicious prosecution. And the only prong, I believe, that they're arguing in the malicious prosecution claim is that we did not meet the favorable termination prong. The test
so is, there,
that,
is there any okay, there was a plea bargain here. I think, you know, there was a compromise charge. And, you know, generally the cases do say that a plea bargain is not a favorable termination or, you know, an indicia of innocence, you know, as a general matter. What takes this case out of that general proposition that, you know, goes back to the common law, the restatement, et cetera?
I believe, and I'm sure, Your Honor, you wrote the opinion, so you're intimately familiar, but I believe the court in Wilkins did not make a bright-line rule. I know that you address the restatement of torts and that there's three factors that are discussed that can be indicators that the case was not dismissed on grounds of innocence. And one of them is a compromise because of misconduct on part of the accused or a mercy requested and granted. It's my reading of Wilkins that this is not a bright-line rule, but that you have to look at all the surrounding circumstances. And
yeah, there's nothing, at least from the Rule 35 hearing, that would suggest the government thought that he was actually innocent or that he could not be retried on the murder charges, is there?
I don't fully agree with that, Your Honor. I think that the transcript, one of the things we can look at, obviously, is the transcript. I think that the defense attorney clearly stated that she thought she had a winnable 35C.
She said it'd be a horse race, a toss-up, it'd be a tough case. That's not conceding that the charges were improperly brought or totally lacked merit.
No, but I don't think we can look at it in a vacuum. I think we have to look back, as the court did in Young, and look at the petition itself. And when you look at the 35C petition, the defendant...
I know where you're going with that. Let me just sort of add this to the mix. Let's agree with you. We'll affirm the district court on this point. What is the fact issue going to be for a jury that would permit you to establish element one, favorable termination? Are you going to have a mini trial on Mr. Montoya's innocence of the murder charges? What's going to happen on remand?
I mean, I think that's part of it, Your Honor.
So a mini trial on whether Mr. Montoya was a part of the murder.
I think to prove favorable termination, what we would envision doing is, which I believe is what we would have to do under Wilkins, is look at all the surrounding circumstances. And here we have three things we can look at. We can look at the 35C petition and what was brought forward in that and what the prosecution knew when they vacated.
Will the prosecutor be a witness?
Yes. I would think we would have to call them, yes. And so would the defense attorney, Ms. Polanski. But I think we could look at the everything that was brought up in the 35C petition, that there was an affirmation from an investigator who had interviewed Nicholas Martinez, who is the true culprit in this crime, and he confirmed that he never met Lorenzo Montoya until the day after the murder, that he was, in fact, the owners of the Broncos jacket that linked Mr. Montoya to the crime during the trial. The DNA testing that showed Mr. Montoya was never wearing the Broncos jacket or the shoes that left footprints at the scene. These are all things that the prosecutor knew when they conceded the 35C.
But the 35C motion, even if you get by the Wilkins versus DeRay's, the compromise, the notion of a compromise, the Rule 35C motion that was attached to the complaint suggests that the motion was not based on innocence of Mr. Montoya. It was based on ineffective assistance of counsel, right?
I agree that
And so the exoneration, so to speak, was predicated not on Mr. Montoya's innocence, but based on the violation of the Sixth Amendment. And so, right? And so it was a violation of his right to effective assistance of counsel. There never was an adjudication that he was innocent of the charge.
Right. I agree that the prosecutor says on the record that they're conceding the 35C based on ineffectiveness, but I don't believe that that's the only thing that this court should look at under Wilkins. I think we have to look at everything the prosecutor knew and everything the defense attorney knew and everything that was in the 35C addition to what was stated on the record.
Did the 35C motion include an argument for collateral relief or 35C relief based on actual innocence?
I believe so, Your Honor. And one other thing I want to point out in terms of the compromise, I don't believe that the plea that Mr. Montoya ended up entering into disqualifies him under favorable termination because there's nothing about what he pled to that indicates that he's guilty of anything related to the murder of Emily Johnson. All the cases cited by the defendants deal with pleas where you are charged with one thing, a felony, on a certain set of facts, and you get a misdemeanor plea on those same set of facts. Or where you are charged, for example, Stein versus City of Westchester, the defendant was originally charged and convicted of sexual assault, and later those charges were dismissed or vacated, and the person pled to endangering the welfare of a child. And I agreed. It was the exact same facts on the same day with the same victim. That's not at all what we have here. He's not pleading guilty to anything that relates to Emily Johnson. He's pleading guilty to sitting in a car the next day that was stolen from her.
Well, that's not actually true, is it? I mean, you can't be an accessory after the fact for sitting in a car that had been stolen. The accessory after the fact conviction was predicated on hindering prosecution of Nicholas.
I'm sorry?
Right? I mean, that's what how can you be convicted of being accessory after the fact of sitting in a stolen car?
Well,
he was accessory after the fact for hindering the prosecution of a first-degree murder that he knew had been committed by Nicholas.
Right, but I agree with everything Your Honor said, but I still don't think that pleading to that and the factual allocution of what his attorney stated is that Mr. Montoya was in a stolen car, a Lexus, knowing it was stolen on January 1st, 2000, and hearing that they had hit some lady over the head with a rock and then remaining in the car and not informing authorities. That's what he said. None of that shows him any way involved in the murder and the burglary of Emily Johnson the night before. I mean, there's nothing in that plea that would show any indicia of guilt of the original charges, all which were vacated. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, I don't question that.
Yes?
I said I do not question. I understand what you said.
Turning to the Fifth Amendment claim, is the testimony at trial a necessary element of proving your Fifth Amendment claim?
I believe so, Your Honor, and I believe we've met that.
Then why wouldn't the absolute testimonial immunity then apply?
Because I believe absolute testimonial immunity only applies to claims for perjury or false statements, which is not what we have. I think the difference is that absolute immunity would apply if we had a claim where we said the officers took the stand and they lied and they perjured himself and we have had a claim based on that. We don't. The reason we mention the officer's testimony is to meet the element that we're required to meet.
Doesn't Renberg, though, use broader language, and it talks about any claim arising from the testimony. Why wouldn't that encompass what happened here?
Because our Fifth Amendment claim doesn't arise from the testimony. It arises from the coercion. So the Fifth Amendment claim.
Your client wasn't injured by the coerced confession until it was introduced at trial, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, but I think if that...
And you'd have to prove injury and damages as a part of your Fifth Amendment claim. And how do you prove your final damages claim without the officers having actually used the testimony at trial?
We would have to prove that they used it at trial, but I still don't believe that the absolute immunity goes as far as to protect them from that. The idea of behind absolute testimonial immunity, I believe that the rationale and the policy reasons for it is to have people freely testify and not be afraid of liability because of their testimony and therefore flavor their testimony in favor of one or the other.
Mr. Doherty right that even perjured testimony would be protected by the immunity?
Yes, he's right, and we don't have a claim for perjured testimony. We have a Fifth Amendment claim, where an element of that claim is to show that the statement that our client made was used against him. If we are to apply absolute immunity, I think that would be incorrect, and I think that that would create a scenario where defendants could ultimately always avoid a Fifth Amendment claim by simply testifying about it. We're required to show that the statement was used against him. In this case, and it's not always the case, but in this case, the statement was put in through the testimony of an officer. If the officers have, and we're not saying he lied, which is what most of the absolute immunity claims deal with. If we are not permitted to meet the element of our defense because of absolute immunity, then prosecutors could always choose to admit a statement through an officer because then there would be no liability.
Is your Fifth Amendment claim against these officers the fact that they coerced testimony, that they coerced statements from your client?
Yes,
Your Honor. Is that your claim?
Yes.
So if that is the claim, is that separate from the testimony that they gave concerning the coerced statements?
Yes, it is, Your Honor, but part of the legal pleading requirements for a Fifth Amendment claim is that we show that for us to be successful on a Fifth Amendment claim, we have to show under the law that the statement was used against him mm-hmm. in a criminal proceeding. And in trying to make that prong, we lay out in our complaint how they used his statement against him. So I don't think absolutely...
Well, you'd have that in your affidavit of probable cause. You wouldn't necessarily need to go to trial testimony.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, thanks.
I know your time's up, but just quickly on the... Is your position that the so-called Reed technique was clearly established as coercive, or that the specific interrogation here was clearly established as coercive under our case law?
Our position is not that the Reed technique itself is unconstitutional. Our position is that the tactics used that we refer to, maybe we shouldn't do this in the future, but that we refer to in our complaint as Reed technique, the separate things that they do under the Reed technique, like lying to him about having his shoe print at the scene or promising he's going to go home or threatening him, the totality of those circumstances is what we believe is unconstitutional.
Great. Thank you, counsel. We appreciate the arguments. We appreciate the well-delivered arguments as well. Counsel are excused, and the case shall be submitted.